Welcome to Lives, a show exploring our experiences in the world and how we might live well. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden, and my guest today is Tim Burke, the retired President and Chief Executive Officer of Omaha Public Power District. We talk about Burke's journey into leadership and the values he modeled, especially in the realm of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the importance of DEI to our community, our organizations, and to Burke personally.
Several CEOs would say, probably taken too many steps forward on this. Be really careful. You know, and I go back to what I had heard from other, I think, really exceptional leaders, if not me, who? If not now, when?
In 1997, Tim Burke joined OPPD, the Omaha Public Power District, as a vice president, serving in various roles across the company until becoming president and CEO in 2015, retiring from that position in 2021. In the summer of 2023, Burke served as president and CEO of the Omaha Chamber of Commerce. He's currently the president of the Offutt Community Development Corporation, focused on projects at Offutt Air Force Base. Burke holds a master's degree from Drake University and a bachelor's degree from Buena Vista University. He's married to Terry, and they have three sons who are married, as well as seven grandchildren. Tim Burke, welcome to Lives.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Stuart.
I love to set the stage sometimes with a guest, and I would love to ask you to just describe your childhood.
Describe my childhood, yes. I am a middle child, so that may, for some who are into order of families, may describe me in a lot of different ways. But I am the oldest son. I have two older sisters and two younger brothers. My father, James, and my mother, Cleofa, were wonderful parents. They are now passed away over 24 years ago, 23, 24 years ago. And so I grew up in Fort Dodge, Iowa. So went to Catholic school for grade school to junior high to high school, went to college at Iowa Central Community College, and then went to Buena Vista University, finished my last 2 years of my undergraduate studies, and then really had the opportunity to move to Des Moines after working for Iowa Illinois Gas and Electric Company in Fort Dodge. Moved to Des Moines and worked for another company called People's Natural Gas Company, part of Utilicorp United. And that's when I went to graduate school at Drake University, as you previously mentioned. But my childhood was really kind of city and farm balanced in some respect. I remember spending a lot of weekends at the farm or in the farm, whether that be mowing or helping my father and tractors and baling hay or whatever they were doing on the farm, we were part of that. And really enjoyed being in the outdoors. And I think that's the reason why I still enjoy it today, being in the outdoors. So I had a wonderful family life and had the opportunity to see my sister this weekend at a visitation, funeral visitation, and just a great family to be part of.
What was life like for you as a child on a farm?
Well, and so you have to kind of, I think I have to characterize it in a weekend, a day at the farm or a weekend at the farm is different than 7 days a week on a farm. And so I really gained an appreciation for those farmers today and those farm families today that are fully embedded 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on a farm doing that work. And just for me to be able to spend that time with my father and my grandfather until he passed away in 1968 was really that experience. And when we were out in the field doing whatever we were doing, whether I was shoveling manure into the manure spreader to fertilize the fields before we plant, and my grandmother driving out in the car to give us lunches. But it was really all around work. It's around getting something accomplished in the day, very specifically. And typically we would go on the weekends and we would mow and we would do some things with chickens, and they had limited cattle, primarily used for for their own food and for their own production, not for mass production and for the markets necessarily. And really a modest acreage. They had 80 acres that they would, you know, essentially move between soybeans and corn and alternate certain segments of that farm in that regard. But really got an appreciation of hard work, which I think led most of my life to understanding that you really do need to work hard. You really do need to be dedicated in whatever you do. And so it's those kinds of early experiences that I think were really valuable for me as a person. And to me, I still love being outdoors. I still mow my own lawn and weed eat. I'm the pool guy. I'm the lawnmower guy, the landscaper, the fertilizer. I do that stuff because I love being outside. I love being to seeing something accomplished very quickly when you mow a lawn and it looks good and looks fresh, or whether you're out in the country. And for many years, my brother and I owned the homestead after my grandparents and parents had passed away, and we planted a variety of trees, Iowa native trees there. And we were there almost every weekend, planting and mowing and just cultivating the trees and watering the trees. They had a well on the property, but we didn't have a distribution system. So that was all done by 5-gallon buckets scattered around over multiple acres to be able to do that. So it's that kind of commitment that I still have today for the outdoors and for land and for farms and appreciation for what our farmers do every single day to make a living and to enjoy their careers.
I did want to ask, there's this juxtaposition then. You mentioned the farm, the rural element of your upbringing, and then the city as you defined it. So what was that part of your early life?
Yeah, so the city life was, I think, pretty typical. Now, the city was a town of 25 or 30,000, so it's all relative. It's not an Omaha, but it is in that community and that part of the state of Iowa, considered a city boy in most cases, right? So for me, it was really around school activities. It was around school athletics. I was an altar boy. I was a lector as I grew older, was a cantor, played guitar for church music on Fridays and sometimes on Sundays. And so it was really around those kinds of communities, whether it be the school community, whether it would be in the church community. And so in the neighborhood, you know, my dad would engage his three sons, and my guess he did something very similar with his daughters in other ways, but we would mow a variety of people's yards in the neighborhood. Now, we joke around that my dad probably got compensated, but we didn't get anything. But that's family folklore. You know, my dad was just a very, very kind individual, giving back to people that needed assistance. And so we would do that. We would mow yards for a variety of the elderly people in the neighborhood. But that was really part of the community and part of the service that my dad, who, you know, grew up as from the farm, was in the army, was in the Korean conflict, was a meat packer for George A. Hormel for many, many years, was on the board of a local credit union. So he had was a trustee in our church at the time. So he had these really unique skill sets where he was a very, very hard worker, but yet he really was respected. And I remember us as the boys, and I think my sister did this as well early on. They had a check pool every week, and so we would on Saturdays we would count all the money, and my dad would determine out of the check pool who was actually the winner. And there are times that we actually got to deliver the checks on Sunday to the families who would receive the check pool dollars, which was kind of cool to see. We could kind of see it full cycle there. We also counted money after masses on Sunday. So my dad, I think, had the fourth Sunday of the week. And so early on, he would bring us there to count and show how we would do the bank statement. And we would deposit the money in the bank and close the drawer and lock it and do all those things. But it was that kind of community work that my dad did that he engaged, you know, his sons in that I think lived with me certainly for really the rest of my life.
So you mentioned this small acreage of the homestead that you and your brother took over once your parents had passed. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind describing sort of just the scale of that and what you were doing with that particular piece of woodland.
Yeah, I would say early on, the concept was really driven around let's create a memorial, so to speak, to kind of give back. And that the farm through estate and work and a variety of different things was sold, but the homestead was retained. And my brother and I thought this would be really just a great opportunity to plant Iowa hardwood trees and just be part of that opportunity for my brother and I to stay connected after the death of our parents, who died very closely from each other. But it was really, for me, during my work week, you know, my kids were in college and post-college in most of that time. And so it was really an opportunity for me just to, and my wife, because Terry would come with me. We would drive 2.5 hours. You know, she would get on a riding lawnmower and over multiple acres and would mow, and we'd get back in our SUV and would just be shaking because, you know, you'd sit on a lawnmower for a couple, 2 or 3 hours, and that's how you feel for a long time afterwards. But she was committed to stay with me and go with me and be part of this. And it was really, to me, I think, a cleansing process. One, it took stress out of my week, just to be outside, being, you know, doing things in the earth, things with trees, things with the acreage and the farmstead that my father grew up on, that my grandparents lived on. And so it was really that kind of earnest, heartfelt need for me to be part of that for a period of time. And then it really got to a point where I couldn't, as job responsibilities grew, and those, you know, continued over weekends, it was just tough for me to get back. And my brother and I kind of got together and said, it's time for us to kind of give this back and an opportunity for those trees to be rescued that were planted, and that property back to the farmer that was contracting on the farm and continue that way of growing and producing corn and soybeans for the markets and how whatever else they did, but we kind of made that decision and because we just couldn't commit to it like we had previously.
Did you intend to be involved in business? Did you always want to be in business?
You know, I would say I knew I had. I was early on in my education. I wanted to be a teacher and a coach, and I think I felt over the course of a couple years of college that as I continued with my business degree and psychology degree, I really had an interest in being focused on labor relations and that kind of work. My dad, part of the meatpacking community, was part of the collective bargaining unit, was part of the union, and whether that stimulated some of that thought process, I don't know. But I knew I wanted to do something that engaged community, customers, relationships, because that's how I grew up, was developing those. And whether it was during sports early on in those kinds of early leadership roles in sports, but it was an opportunity for me to kind of take that skill set and to kind of move it kind of anywhere I think I really wanted to move it. And I just happened after graduation, right before graduation, my old AAU basketball coach's wife called and said, would you be interested in interviewing for a job right here in town with the local utility? And it was kind of like, my wife's family's living there. Most of my family was living there. Yeah, it's great to be, you know, kind of stay in the home and not have to relocate. And so we did that for 5 years. And then essentially went to graduate school because they didn't have online graduate classes at the time. And so, funny enough, I would have to drive to Ames to go to graduate school. Now, that was only 45 or 50 minutes away from Fort Dodge. So as I think about it in a metropolitan, it would be going from southeast Sarpy to northwest Douglas, and by golly, we do that today, but that just wasn't what you did and how you did it. So we decided to move to Des Moines and go to finish my education at Drake University. And that's where I began to kind of get an appreciation where I was engaged with customers, both manufacturing customers, but also agricultural customers. So there always has been this kind of tie to agriculture and farm and rural that I think benefited me, and just understanding, have an appreciation of the difference between those two and the similarities between those.
You took the role of president and CEO of OPPD in 2015. But what was it that leading up to that time made you feel as if you were ready for that role?
I think over a period of time. So I had been with the company from 1997 and 2015. So, you know, it was almost 18 years I was with the company. But in that time, I probably had most accountability for some of the functions at OPPD, except for the generation side of the business and the finance side of the business, and had other roles and responsibilities for me just to learn and to engage differently in the business, got an appreciation for the broader utility rather than just a customer or a marketing or a strategy kind of element to a business. And it really gave me an appreciation of the folks that are committed to doing this utility work. And, you know, we really don't think about them till there's an outage or a problem or an issue. But there are immensely committed people serving customers in eastern Nebraska and all over the world from the utility segment. And that was, to me, very honorable work to be able to do that. But it was that diversity of over a period of 18 years of having the accountability to do a variety of different things really gave me a confidence that I could really be an exceptional leader with based on that experience. And then in each of my roles, really, I think really nurturing and growing my leadership capability and really the confidence of the organization, up and down the organization, from the executive team to the folks every day, you know, tying their boots on and going into a power plant or going into a line truck or going into a substation or putting on a belt with a variety of different tools. I really had that relationship really up and down the organization that I thought would lead me to be just an exceptional leader at the time.
So it wasn't that long ago, but there was probably an interview process, and I bet in that interview you were asked a question along the lines of, why do you want this job? And I don't want you to rehash that. I actually want to ask, what's the real reason why you wanted to be the president and CEO?
Well, I really think I could have made a difference. I think make a difference to do things that maybe I did not see occur in the organization that I think we could have done a better job on. I think anybody who takes on that kind of leadership role always has the desire to make changes and to do things differently. And I think the organization was ready from kind of my leadership style. And so for me, it was really around kind of getting into the power plants and going to the docks of our centers and going out into the field and engaging our employees. And I did that in all the different business units that I had accountability for, but then to really do it across the organization and to engage the organization in that way, I think was really positive. So to me is, I really think I could make a difference. I could improve the organization, improve the culture, improve the business, begin to think about things differently and how the organization ought to transition to what we identified at that time, the kind of the new energy marketplace. And we still see that transition occurring in this utility space that I was in today.
As many leaders as there are, I would imagine there are leadership styles or definitions of leadership. So maybe just a little, stepping back a little bit from you, how do you think of leadership? How do you define a leader?
You know, I think a leader is, you know, someone is willing to take action, right? To take action and engage others in that action for the benefit of an organization, benefit of a business, benefit of a family. And I think leadership is kind of one of those interesting elements. I always talk about it in the four C's, kind of clarity, connection, care, and the last one is really consistency. So as a leader, you need to create clarity for people in the organization at all levels. about what is this organization going to be about? How are we going to do it? What's important? How are we going to act as an organization? What are we willing to do in the community? So that kind of clarity, as well as you get down to individual goals and objectives and those kinds of pieces. But everyone wants, I believe everybody wants that clarity. They just want to know what's expected of them. And so just be clear about it. The connection piece is really, I think, fits right into my personality. So that wasn't a jump for me. But how do I connect with all the employees up and down the organization, whether it's union leadership or management leadership? How do I do that? How do you connect with them? How do I get to know them? And it's that kind of connection and just understanding individuals in the organization that to me was really important. So how do you make that connection? So clarity, connection, care is one of those, is just begin to put yourself in other people's shoes in the organization. And to me, I think those kinds of things made me a better leader. I began to think about things as that if I was in that role, what would I want to hear from my CEO of the company? How would I want my CEO to act? How would I want to engage with them around that? And then the consistency piece is whether it's firefighting, an emergency situation, or just a normal blue sky Sunday or Saturday, how are you going to lead as an individual? And that consistency is really important, because if it isn't consistent, the organizations begin to wonder and begin to really determine, can they trust them? And so that consistency, I think, is really important. And to me, they all lined up. Now, maybe that was a self-fulfilling prophecy that these four things kind of lined up with me, but I kind of live them out today. And I give examples to people that you can carry these four C's into a family setting around clarity, around connection, around care, around consistency, and they seem to work for me. And so that's how I thought about leadership in an organization, about how do you get things done with these kind of elements.
So, you know, one enters a role and then one experiences the ups and downs of the context, what is thrown at you. One obvious example through during your tenure, of course, was a global pandemic. That was on no one's strategic plan. So I'm curious about, as you encountered actually living into that role, what were the hardest parts of it? And perhaps what were the best parts of it that you could really flourish into?
Yeah, I think to me, it was very interesting in the pandemic, and the example that you just gave, how we really embraced the organization. And again, we had an organization that really, I'm going to simplify it by say there's a group that are in offices, and then there are a group that are outside offices and at centers and in power plants, in substations. And the difficulty of that pandemic was to think that we could create a solution for everybody. And they really had to have two different solutions. One is, we found very clearly that the age of the building that we were in and Energy Plaza was not fit for a pandemic environment at the time. And so we had to make some adjustments. And so did we have the technology to have people work from home? What does that look like? And so we had groups and teams of people that began to work through this very clearly. And our safety group was deeply involved with University of Nebraska Medical Center, with the health departments, working across the state with other utilities, really with other utilities that were seeing the pandemic long before we did, and long before maybe 30, 60, 90 days, but what was going on the East Coast and what was going on the West Coast. So the other large public power council members that we had in the state of Washington and California and New York were really informative of the experiences that they've had, and then how should we begin to think about that as a utility? So how do you connect kind of those experiences into the best alternative that we had? And so that was kind of the direction. You got to engage employees. How do you communicate with employees? And what we heard during that process, and again, this was really driven by employees that were part of our pandemic team saying, we need to communicate with employees more than we've ever communicated with them. So how do we use the technology? How do we use Zoom? And how do we use all the other capabilities to get our teams together, right, to make sure that we can still think about clarity, connection, care, and consistency, and what does that look like? And so we began to develop those kinds of initiatives around that. And I think from a utility perspective, I think we managed through that incredibly well. You know, we had some people that got very, very sick in that pandemic process. But I think we also kept people from getting very, very sick and not dying because of some of the actions that we took early on. That maybe early on in the process, people said, that's too far. But I would prefer to err on that side and feel comfortable as we kind of managed through that pandemic, that we had people that were healthy and an organization that was healthy and an organization that was still communicated with, that was still delivering on every single promise we made to customers about service and reliability, around price, around corporate and community partnership.
I'm getting a strong sense of leadership values. So values, leadership style, you mentioned the four C's, for example. You also use the shorthand expression about taking action as part of a leadership commitment, which is taking me in the direction of asking you about an initiative called Lead Diversity. Mm. And you were not just OPPD, which is a major partner in that endeavor, mm-hmm. along with the Tri-Faith Initiative, with the Chamber. Of course. And it's facilitated by inclusive communities. But without your personal leadership in getting that going, I don't know if it would have happened. But so let's talk about Lead Diversity a little bit. Sure. What is it?
Well, Lead Diversity is really, if you think about Leadership Omaha, how do you cultivate leaders in the community? And the Omaha Chamber, whether it would be the Executive Institute or would it be the Omaha Chamber's Leadership Omaha, is how do you gather people around the community to learn about the community? Lead Diversity was really, how do you do that same kind of format, but learn about diversity and diversity challenges within our community? And those two, whether in Leadership Omaha and Lead Diversity, you may or may not see continuity or consistency across those. You may touch and hear some things, but not really put the lens of how are we doing as a community around inclusion, around equity, whether it's around health or finance or rent or housing or engagement. And so Lead Diversity is really to gather leaders in an organization just to begin to have that experience, communication, and conversations, and to really take that conversation back to your business, just like Omaha leadership folks would be bringing back initiatives that they may want to engage on in their business. And so that was the premise about how do we begin to develop people that are hearing about diversity, equity, inclusion differently than if they weren't part of Lead Diversity. And so OPPD, and really I would kind of wave the flag for Joyce Cooper, who's been an outstanding supporter of all the diversity initiatives, not only at OPPD, but across this community and nationally, with some of the work she's doing on some of the National Energy Consortium work that she's doing with the Large Public Power Council and the workforce initiatives that she's doing. But with that was really Mart Sedke, the late Mart Sedke, who was our Vice President of Human Resources. And I, both Mart and Joyce were just amazing people that would really counsel me and to give me insight and perspective that maybe didn't come to me right away. And they were just amazing about it. One, they were relentless, which, you know, God love them. You know, I would say, I never say no to Joyce because she's always right. And I would do whatever she wants me to do. And the same thing with Mart, because she was really that kind of diversity leader across the community, across the human resource continuum, that really was looking at OPB to take a leadership role on it. And then when you take a leadership role in the community, then the community is better. And others join us. I remember Pat Dees with Woodmen of the World. We were at one of our inclusive community conversations, and And someone asked him, Pat, what do you do at Woodman of the World? And he, and I was sitting at his table, and he turned to me and he said, I just follow what OPPD is doing. And that was very, very nice to hear, but I think it reflects on how leadership can make an impact in the community. And so Pat understood that. He may not have that intuitive nature within the organization at the time, but they began to develop their own diversity, internal diversity initiatives that began to make that organization different going forward. And it's that kind of comments that we heard that really, because of Joyce and because of Mark's work and because of my willingness to listen and agree to move forward, really began to make a difference for OPPD and I think the community, and put us in a much better position.
We can't ignore the context of our conversation now. And by that, I mean there's a different kind of public conversation around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I've heard you, for example, frame elements of the benefits and the opportunities with this kind of program around, for example, retaining and attracting talent of all stripes, just as one example. So there's clearly a practical, but there's also a moral component to this. Now, I'm just wondering how you, at this point, continue, as it were, to promote the ethos of lead diversity.
No, that's really, really a great comment, because I think, you know, this isn't a on or off, I don't think, element that any business ought to take a look at. Businesses ought to look at, have they embedded the principles of diversity, equity, inclusion within their organization to the point where they feel comfortable that they're moving forward in a very, very positive way and not separating or negatively impacting different audiences within the organization. And I think the community is in the same way. I would say this is a lifelong commitment that Terry and I have made around our commitment around diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives. And I will tell you, whether it's women's rights, whether it's gay rights in the state, you know, we stay actively personally in those kinds of things, whether it be financially or in our support of people and organizations that are doing, I think, just amazing work. And then those that want to take away a leader's ability to develop diversity initiatives that they believe are important to their organization, whether it's a university organization, whether it's a not-for-profit, whether it's a private organization. But we have the political side of this coming in and saying we shouldn't do these kinds of things. It's wrong. I don't think it's the politics side to dictate that. I think a good business leader will understand, does my organization need to have an emphasis and a focus to be a better organization? And at OPPD, I always thought, and I'll give you just a couple examples of that, if we did not focus and work on initiatives around diversity, equity, inclusion at OPPD, we would not have the organization that we have today. People would not stay with our organization. And I remember sitting in new employee orientations that people said, this is the reason why I'm coming to OPPD, is because of the work that you're doing. And I had a young gay employee that came up to me as just in the walking in Energy Plaza before the pandemic, where we were having lunch, and he came in. He said, I just want to let you know, I feel safer in this organization than I've felt anywhere in my life. And I just want to thank you. And he gave me the biggest hug, and I embraced him as well. And it was that kind of indication to me that we're doing all the right things. And I would want to continue that at OPPD and across this community, because I still think it's necessary. From a leader, maybe sitting on the outside looking in now, not within the business community, but we still have pockets of racism and diverse thinking that is not good for our community long term, and maybe across the state too.
I don't know if you want to talk about this, Tim, or not, but I did see an interview that you gave. I can't remember where it was now, but you made reference to policies that don't include people, that make people feel more marginalized than they are. It can drive talent away. It drives people away from the state. And of course, we're really concerned about, every organization, community is concerned about talent leaving because they don't feel welcome to express their talents. But in this interview, I think you mentioned that your own son had, right. had felt that pressure. And I don't know if that's something you want to share.
I'd be more than willing to talk about it. My son, between his junior and senior year at UNO, essentially came to Terry and I and essentially said, "Dad, I'm gay." And of course, you know, as a parent, I think you have a couple avenues you can take. You can say at 21 years old, I don't think you understand and know yourself, or I absolutely love you and I will support you. And Terry and I followed on the last element of that and said, listen, we're going to support you. It's going to be a tough road. You're going to have tough times as you come out in this. And in that process, decided to move to the East Coast and decided to be moved to Boston, where it appeared to be a much better environment for gay and lesbian, and state legislation was more beneficial and open around that conversation and discussion. But I tell you, it hurt when he left. And when he left, there was a variety of professionals that we knew that he hung with that were now doctors and critical care nurses and artists and retail restaurateurs that left this community that we knew were just exceptional people because of, at that time, what the city of Omaha was doing around whether gay or lesbian or sexual orientation were part of the discrimination policy within the city. And he made that decision to leave. And that was harmful for our family. That changed our family dynamics. And but he had to do something that he felt he needed to do to be safe and be part of a community that he was going to be supportive of. So I know people are leaving this community because of how we think about diversity and equity inclusion, because of the legislation and the actions and even the nomenclature that politicians use at the, sometimes even at the highest level, and even at the federal government side that talks about diversity in this, it doesn't really matter in this state. It's not that big of a deal. It is a big deal, and we ought to pay more attention to it. And we are losing talent because of that, and maybe because of other things, but that is certainly one element that if I was a leader of politics today, would begin to think about things a little differently.
Even now, it feels courageous of you, but of any leader in this community, to not play it safe. It always feels intriguing to me to see a leader actually really stand up for a set of values. But was there a point when you ever thought, I should back off this stance a little bit because I'm a very prominent, you know, well-observed leader in the community, and maybe I should just play it a little safer.
I did have several CEOs in this community that would say, you've probably taken too many steps forward on this. Be really careful. You know, and I go back to what I had heard from other, I think, really exceptional leaders, if not me, who? If not now, when? And so it really became an element to me as I began to learn about my own white privilege. You know, my son and I just had this conversation about coming from a blue-collar family. I really felt, this was my bias, this is my ignorance, I really felt I had a similar upbringing of folks that I was a mentor for early on at OPPD. You know, an African-American, you know, electrical engineer. His dad was in a manufacturing facility. He played sports and we would talk about things, but it came very clear to me that our lives are completely different in every day and every phase of our life. And it was that bias of that I had, my white privilege bias, that to me was my ignorance, that I'll be honest with you, didn't really have that opportunity and maybe personally didn't want to take that opportunity. But it was obvious as a leader, I needed to tell people that I am white privileged. I'm a white privileged leader. And I remember Henry Cordes sitting in a room once at OPPD on a diversity panel that we were doing. And I kind of started down this path of being a white privileged leader. And afterwards he came up and he said, I've never heard a leader in Omaha talk like that before. Why would you say that? I said, because I'm finding out from myself. I'm learning kind of my background, my experiences, and kind of where I am. And I never thought I had that bias, but it's now being exposed that I have that bias. And I need to get it out, because I can't deal with it if I don't get it out. So let's get it out. Let's have the conversation. And that became really, I think, an opportunity for me to begin to talk about that very broadly. And when I became a president of the Greater Omaha Chamber, one of the initiatives was really to grow the DEI work at the chamber. It was because of that. And I think there was folks that supported that, but they supported it quietly and they thought it was the right thing to do, but many folks didn't know how to do it. And so I think I became really the vehicle for the community to begin to talk and to begin to say those words and do those things. And it was easier for other CEOs to kind of begin to talk and to put actions in place and to make changes in their organization because of some of that. And I don't know if it was intentional, to be honest with you. To me, it was a personal intention of mine as part of my kind of bias therapy, that I needed to begin to talk like that and to begin to talk differently. And so I had to unwrap these biases that I really didn't think I had, by the way. And then they became very obvious that I did. And I needed as a leader to address that.
I'm going to read a quote to you, and I'm hoping you recognize this. Life may end, but love and music will endure forever. And just yes or no, you recognize?
Oh, yes,
okay.
I do.
So
yes, I do.
So for the listeners, would you just share the context of that?
Yeah. So life may end, but love and music will endure forever. So we had a family Irish band called the Shenanigans. It was the Shenanigans, and it was really early on my nephew and I, who taught music at Pius High School in Lincoln, and then he moved to Milwaukee, and my oldest son, my middle son, and then my youngest son kind of joined in the Shenanigans, small s, but joined the big band Shenanigans. But on our shirt and on our koozies, we would have this saying that life may end, but love and music will endure forever. And we really believe that music, I think, is a healer. To me, it's a healer. It was a stress reliever for me. It was an opportunity for me to go to the basement of the Doubler and play Irish music. And nobody knew me as the CEO of OPPD, and nobody knew me as an executive with OPPD. They knew me as a Irish guitar singer player, and that was really fun. But that's where that quote came from, and we still use it today.
Early in our conversation, you mentioned church and being involved as a child, but playing guitar as mm-hmm. as part of that worship process and experience. And I may be wrong, but I think the guitar also found its home in your CEO office at OPPD, and you weren't afraid to break it out.
I did. It was in my office. I had a travel guitar that I had in my office. And there were days in my life in that CEO office that, you know, were some stressful or at times, and it was an opportunity for me just to take that guitar, shut the door, and play a little bit. But I would also use that to go sing happy birthday to people throughout the building. And it would just shock the heck out of them. But, you know, because what CEO really does that? And so that was really a tool for me to think about, how do I connect with people, and how do I do that authentically? And that was me. So, and that was fun. And I still do some of that today. I will still do a little recording and send it to people on their birthdays, and have done that just in the last month or so.
So before we move off music then, clearly it's been an important part of your life. Would you expand just a little bit more on the place of music, and not least a family band, but the place of that in your life?
Well, yeah, I think a couple things. So now there's two families. There's another dad, a bass player, and myself. He has two sons, and I have two sons that are now in the band. And so it is family, and we get along incredibly well. We're good friends. We travel together, the bass player and I, and you know, our wives travel together. They're good friends. But it is part of this. It's amazing what happens when you play music that people like to sing to. I mean, it's an endorphin change. It's could be relaxation. It could be excitement. It could be fun for families. And you know, we do a Hooli for the Lady Hibernians every year, and we see families and kids that are dancing and families that are singing, and you can just tell it's a good day when people do that. We love doing it, but it's good for us to be able to do that. And we play music that people sing along to, whether it's Roy Orbison or Johnny Cash or Eagles or a bunch of Irish pub sing-alongs. We play music that people love, that we love, and that people like to sing along to. And we do a lot of fundraisers in that regard, where we don't necessarily charge because we believe in their mission. You know, whether it's Partnership for Kids or Habitat for Humanity, we do a variety of things free of charge. But it's part of our opportunity to give back to the community as well.
So you've retired from what is a billion-dollar plus entity that touches so many lives. And I'm curious how you've made that transition from leading a billion-dollar entity into retirement.
You know, the transition was really interesting for me, and I think the pandemic was helpful, actually, for me in that transition. Because I did work from home a couple days a week. And so you often wonder, you know, I would leave early in the morning and be some late nights and community nights. And so could Terry and I actually, you know, be in the same house together, because she has her things and I had my things. And so can you do that? And we found that we could do that. We could kind of live those kinds of environments as a couple. You know, because we've been married, you know, we got married in 1982. So, you know, we're on this 42-year run, and I think we're going to make it. I really do. You probably should talk to her about that, but I think we're going to make it. I think she would say that too. But the transition for me was really interesting, because I did not feel my job was stressful. There were times it was. But when you leave that, and you're not getting a text at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. or 6 a.m. or you have this injury or that injury or something happened to the system or regionally or a pandemic or whatever it may be. That was very clearly a sign over the first couple of days that I'm not getting those texts, I'm not getting those emails. And even though, you know, some of the executives and people at OPPD and I still get together and talk, I think it's really more them giving me information than me providing any insight or counsel. But it's good to engage with the folks that are doing just some great work. But I kind of transitioned that to other community kind of led activities. And it's really been around our military men, women, and families, and really began to spend time and energy with the Office Advisory Council, STRACOP Consultation Committee, and you mentioned this in the intro, now the president of the Offutt Community Development Corporation, to really think about how we can improve the base for future missions, for quality of life initiatives for the men and women and families. And so that has really been my focus since retirement. There's been some other community things that I do and still help people with some diversity, equity, inclusion, some executive leadership kind of activities, but that's probably 90% of the work that I do now is really around off at Air Force Base and really making sure that we as a community are supportive of the men and women. And that includes, you know, some things we're doing with federal delegates, with state representatives, with base leadership, and engaging them. And, you know, Offutt Advisory Council probably raised almost $300,000 last year. We've never raised that kind of money before, but we're seeing our need to raise those dollars to really support initiatives at the base, whether it's the Airman's Pantry, whether it's the Spouses Group, whether it's a number of initiatives that are going on at the base. So that's been really my focus, and I'm loving it, and there'll be a time where I probably wean away from that and find something else to do or not do, but that's been my focus over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm.
this is a long set of experiences, and I'm wondering what it is that you have learned about yourself as you have journeyed through that life.
Yeah, that's an interesting reflection. The one element I guess I would kind of lean on is someone told me just being you is enough, right? So you don't have to be somebody bigger than you or better than you, but if you just be yourself, yourself is good enough. And sometimes I think as leaders, we try too hard to be other people, to do other things others would do, rather than just being ourselves. And maybe that just is outside of executive leadership. Maybe it's just people, right? So just be yourself, be authentic, because that's enough. That's enough. And the world is better because of that. And I think that's been a big learning. And once you kind of get that out of the way, then just be yourself, be your authentic self, and do the things you like to do and how you like to do it and how you like to help people or organizations or parts of the community, and everyone's better because of that.
My guest today has been Tim Burke, the retired president and chief executive officer of the Omaha Public Power District. Tim, thanks so much for joining us. It's been fun.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Stuart. I appreciate it.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.